This is day one of the 2015 Ottawa Bible School. Our third period teacher is Brother Jim Stiles. His general topic is Jeremiah, Change Before It's Too Late. Today's topic is Redirecting Your Life for God. Brother Jim.
Thanks, Jeff. Good morning, everyone. I hope you don't mind if I just stand down here and talk to you, if that works for you. That way, I don't have to be behind the screen. If you don't like the way I look, maybe you'd rather have me behind the screen, but we could do that too. Yes. Jeremiah. It's always fun at a Bible school to be able to talk about a subject that we're doing in the readings. So, right, we're up to Jeremiah 10 today, right? Jeremiah 10. And if I ask you to give you a summary of like what's happened so far, how would we do? See? The problem with Jeremiah is it's 50-some chapters long. It goes on in the readings, the daily reading chart, if you use them for, a month and a half or something like that. And I think what's happened for a lot of us in life is we've just sort of left it as one of those books like Revelation that maybe someday and maybe not. That's probably what's happened. And when you're reading through the first 20 chapters, it almost sounds like every day is about the same thing, doesn't it? It sort of like blurs into one big long, God chewing out the people for how bad they've done and Jeremiah crying his eyeballs out. I mean, that's about what it looks like. And, that's one level that you can read Jeremiah. I'm hoping that this week we're going to find out that there's more levels than that and we'll get a chance to look at some of the other things that are there. What I want to do today, though, is just look at the background. We're going to first of all start out with some of the background to Jeremiah's time to bring us up to speed. And then after that, we'll move forward and probably cover chapter one today, maybe a couple other things. And then we'll move on in the future into other things beyond. But what happens with Jeremiah, 52 chapters, it's a long book to study. I don't think it's really covered much in Sunday school. I can remember when Stu and I were teaching the CSS lessons that we had, CSSS, it's like Jeremiah just sort of got skipped. And so kids grew up with like hardly any understanding of Jeremiah. And unless you're doing the Bible readings at home and you're talking with your children, a lot of times they grow up not knowing much about Jeremiah at all. The other problem you run into is the chapters of Jeremiah are out of chronological order once you pass chapter 21. And so that confuses people. You try to figure out, what in the world's going on? Why are they all out of order? And I will give you a suggestion on that, which makes a lot of sense to me, but hopefully I'll leave that for later, and you'll have to listen carefully to catch that. But anyways, it is one of those subjects that you figure you're going to put off till later on, but now we're going to actually get a chance to look at it. As far as the resources go, I picked the study of Jeremiah. I probably started it maybe 25 years ago. Got really interested one time. Sue may remember, I ran a fever one time. I got back from one of our trips to Florida with the family, and I was still sick when we got back. I think I spent like a week up in our room upstairs. I hardly ever came out because the fever was so bad. Skipped school the first week after Christmas vacation, which they always figure, you extended your vacation, right? As a teacher, at least, they think that, what are you doing? Well, you're not coming back after vacation. But I was really sick, and I started reading a series of articles in the Testimony magazine that Tony Benson had written called The Friends of Jeremiah. And it really got me interested in trying to understand what was going on in the book of Jeremiah. I'd highly recommend them. If you have the Testimony magazines electronically, you can go back and find those. They were really good. Brother Harry Whitaker's book, Of Whom the World Was Not Worthy, which you see pictured up there, that's actually the best book I have found on Jeremiah. C.C. Walker did write a book on Jeremiah, but I don't really put it up there in the category of an extended study. I think it was more a case of where he wrote articles in the Christadelphian just to keep up to speed, and then they compiled them into a book, and you'll notice it went out of print for a lot of years, and they didn't even bother reprinting it. But we have other books that are much more useful. Brother Harry Whitaker's book is really good and easy to read. Speaker's Commentary, in England they call it Speaker's. Here we call it F.C. Cook's Commentary, the Bible Commentary, because it was edited by F.C. Cook. Really good on a lot of the historical parts of Jeremiah, trying to piece together what's actually happening in the book. And for all of the audio people who don't like to read books today, especially the younger audience out there, we have tapes available, or what you can now call digital media. You can download MP3 files and find out some things about Jeremiah. Brother Ron Cowie's got some classes on livoniatapes.com, and Brother John Martin's got 7 classes, and the 6 I did at Hanover are there as well for those of you that miss things here. You can always pick those up on livoniatapes.com. Or I'm sure you put these classes here, you put them out on the website, right, when it's all over at some point. So they're going to be available. And so will the notes. The PowerPoints will be available for you as well. By the way, LavoniaTapes.com, if you're wondering like why we called it that, LavoniaTapes.com, my son Andrew actually made the website when he watched me years ago when I was copying tapes and sending them out to Christadelphians all over North America. I would get them in from Australia, copy them, mail them out. And he looked at me and he said one day, "Dad, you're so far behind." He said, "You really should catch up in the digital age." And he said, "You know, you're so far behind that there's no sense even going to CDs. We've even bypassed that." He said, "You might as well just copy them right into MP3 files. I'll make you a website. We'll post them online. Everybody can just download them free and save you all that postage and the cost of the tapes and everything." And so he did. That was an amazing thing to me. I don't know how to do that, but he wrote some program in HTML or something like that. And, you know, we sort of looked at him like, you know, he was, you know, what are you doing? But it worked. Then when he went to get a job in California, he turned that in as part of his resume of showing them that he could actually write HTML programs and actually got him a job in California, which was really nice. So anyway, it's amazing how things pay off in life that you just don't expect. So the game plan for these classes, we'll look at how God redirected Jeremiah, first of all, in this class today. Tomorrow we're going to look at the failure of the people. What went wrong at this point in time? What went wrong? And try to get a real understanding from Jeremiah's prophecy about what that was. And then in class 3 is probably one of the most interesting ones because it's Jeremiah's struggle with God's plan. I don't know whether you've ever picked this up before in the first 20 chapters. We're up to chapter 10 now in the readings. Have you noticed how Jeremiah pops in every so often and he says, "What are you doing, God? You can't do this." Or even like in the chapter today, when he talks about, you know, in chapter 10, when he was asking a question about, you know, it's not in the way of man to understand, yet you've got to do something, God. We can't do this ourselves. He's like throwing it back on God, like, you got to send them some better prophets. You've got to do something because this isn't happening. The people aren't changing. And he's throwing back to God that something's got to be done. And he's expecting God to actually make some of that. And if you're not careful when you're reading through, you don't even notice those things. We don't look at it as a dialogue between God and Jeremiah. And you'll see that in class 3. Then in 4, we're going to look at Jehoiakim, who's probably one of the worst kings that Judah ever had, the king without a conscience. And then we'll do the Rechabites. What a great, you know, thing to see the Rechabites in there in Jeremiah 35. And then finally Zedekiah. We'll end up with Zedekiah, the king without a backbone. Zedekiah is the guy that kept having Jeremiah come and talk to him, say, "Jeremiah, what's the word of the Lord? What's going on?" But he wouldn't do anything, because he was, you know, held hostage by the princes. And so when they throw Jeremiah in the pit, he lets them do it. And then Ebed-Melech comes and says, wants to get him out. He says, "Okay, you can get him out." But he just didn't have any backbone to stand up to the people. But the message overall is really change before the end begins. Because if you wait until the end, it's too late. And I really think that is a key message for today. Some of us are sitting there thinking, "Well, I'll wait until Russia attacks the Middle East. I'll wait until, you know, something happens. They're going to wait until Christ returns, and then I'm going to really get my life together." And Jeremiah has to go out and tell the people, "This is going to be like a fire. This is going to be like a woman in childbirth. Once it starts, you can't stop it." Or if you saw the pictures of that fire on I-15, you know, over the weekend, that was terrible, that fire that swept up over and burned cars and all that. He compares it to a fire like that, that once it starts, there's going to be no putting it out. This time, God is going to carry it through. And that's what will happen when Christ returns. Christ is going to say to us, "Look, you had all these opportunities. You had all these opportunities in your life. I kept waiting and waiting for you to get serious. And the end has come." And Jeremiah has to deliver that message. Not a very popular message to deliver. If you go back and look at some of the historical time periods right here, and you go back and look at what happened right before Jeremiah, it's good to realize that we're in the time period here where Hezekiah had come along, and what had he done? A great reformation. And you think, wow, that would stick with the people for a while. He tore down those idols. He dumped them in the river. And they thought, wow, this is great. He took them down to Gehenna, and he dumped them down there in the Valley of Hinnom. And then Manasseh comes along, goes down to Hinnom, goes down to the river, and pulls them back out again and sets them all up that fast. And that's what had happened. 55 years of Manasseh's reign. And Amon was no better. Even though Manasseh appears to have changed at the end of his life, he couldn't change his son Amon. Right? That's what's happening in the historical background right before Jeremiah comes on the scene. Because Jeremiah is going to come in the 13th year of Josiah, who's going to come in right after Ammon. It's good to keep the kings in mind as we're going through Jeremiah. You only have to have, five of them, really, that are the major key players. In fact, Jehoahaz isn't really even mentioned very much, and nor is Jehoiachin. But they are the three main ones would be Josiah up there, because Jeremiah starts in the 13th year of Josiah. And then Jehoahaz is next. He's the one who gets carried down to Egypt and by Pharaoh Necho. And then Pharaoh Necho puts in Jehoiakim as the king. And then you have Jehoiachin, who's the son of back there with Jehoiakim. And then finally, we end up with Zedekiah. And those are really the three. You got J, 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 Z. Easy for the Canadians, right? Because you end up with Z. They don't have any trouble with that one. But for the rest of us, keeping all these J's straight is confusing. And it doesn't help the fact that they're actually given different names, too. So there isn't just one name for these guys. There's a couple of names. So hopefully we'll get used to that, and you'll see how that works. I always found it useful to have Josiah's descendants figured out. Because for years, I used to think that list I just showed you, I used to think, well, these are all the son of, the son of, the son of, the son of, right down to the end. And then you come to find out, wait a minute, that isn't what really happened. When Josiah died, remember when Pharaoh Necho went up to fight in the battle at Carchemish, and he came back down and because he had killed Josiah on the way up? He comes back down, and the people of the land had put in Jehoahaz as the king. That was who they chose, even though he was the third son of Josiah. They knew this guy was terrible, I think, and there's no way they were going to make him king. So Pharaoh Necho, after 3 months, takes Jehoahaz down to Egypt, and he installs Jehoiakim as king for 11 years. This guy was terrible. He's the one that Jeremiah prophesied and said, this guy is so bad, he's going to die in a siege, and he's going to be dragged out and thrown over the wall of Jerusalem and just left out there to suffer the heat by day and the cold by night. This was a terrible king, Jehoiakim. And then finally, after Jehoiakim, after he reigns, his son comes in, Jehoiachin, but again, only for 3 months. And he comes in at that point. And then when he's taken away by Nebuchadnezzar installs Zedekiah as the next king. This would be like when Ezekiel was taken captive in this period here. Daniel would have been back here in Jehoiakim's. And then if you're wondering, what happens after that, well, then you have the Ezra-Nehemiah period. And finally, you figure out, well, Zerubbabel actually came in the line of Jehoiachin, which is a surprise to a lot of people. That's actually the way it works. And then from Zerubbabel, you can go on down the line from there. But that's, you read Luke 3 or Matthew 1, Zerubbabel's in both lines. Now, this handout that you've got, if you pick up the handouts on the way in, hopefully Uncle Jeff made an announcement to pick up the handouts. And if you pick those up, I try to give you some things I compiled that I found useful for myself. Probably 25 years ago, you can tell by the old IBM type font right there. That's really old, right? I put the red dots in just so you could see them better in the back. But what I was trying to do was compile the events, the major events that are in Jeremiah, and try to figure out, well, how do you sequence them? What's actually happening? One of the things that falls out from that is that you're going to find out that a lot of Jeremiah's chapters right here, where they're listed, you'll notice a lot of them are clumped by the red dots. Now, the red dots, what are they? Those are times when a foreign nation invaded. So what God did is he sort of let the people go for a while, realized how bad they were getting, sends in a foreign invader who took many of them away and left a few in the land. And when the people finally sat up and noticed, oh, God did something, then he sent Jeremiah to deliver the message and figured this is the best time to get the people to listen. So that's why the chapters of Jeremiah seem to be compiled at some of those key events. If you're wondering why they're so out of order right here, I'll tell you right now, the suggestion that I found in Cook's commentary that's made the most sense to me is that those of us that try to put them back into chronological sequence like I did when I was younger, you can do that and try to get the chronology straight about what actually happened, but you miss the point of what Jeremiah was trying to do. And what he did, we think, is he got Barak to take the writings that he had done and he recompiled them as a new king came along and tried to influence that king. So at the end down here with Zedekiah, what he does is he goes back and he recompiles these things and puts them together in such an order to say, look it, here's what Josiah did. Here's what we predicted about what was going to happen. Here's what Jehoiakim did. God said, if you don't change, I'm going to bring in a foreign invader. And he did. And finally to Zedekiah, he says, look, this is what God said all along would happen. And this is why you'll see Josiah, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, all like mentioned together in just a few chapters. He's trying to thematically impress Zedekiah, you're the end. This is it. If you don't change, this is the last straw, and the whole nation is going captive. This is the end. The end has come. And so they had been left compiled the way he left them for Zedekiah. That's actually in the speaker's commentary. And to me, that makes a lot of sense when you go back and look at these chapters in this period right here. It makes a lot of sense to see how they're put together. And that's why you'll see things like right here of 21, 23, and 32 to 34, 37 to 39. And they're all like compiled in this one time period there because he's trying to impress Zedekiah. And that's probably why they're so out of order. So he's trying to impress Zedekiah, put some pressure on Zedekiah. Don't be such a king without a backbone. Do something, Zedekiah, and make a difference. And he just couldn't do it. God was right. The end had come. Now, when you go back and look at what Jeremiah was living through, this has always impressed me. Jeremiah was alive and lived and began prophesying. So he's probably around, 20, 25 years old, in the 13th year of Josiah. That's when he starts, 13th year. Now, you go back and look at Josiah's reformation. Everybody studied that in Sunday school, and you're well aware of that in the readings. He's only 8 years old when he becomes king, right? In the 8th year of his reign, he began to seek God. In the 12th year of his reign, he began to purge Judah of idols, and he goes even up to the north, and he tries to make an impact on the northern nation at that point. Now, if you had been alive back then, though, look how confusing that would be to you. You would have had prophets for all of your lifetime that were just telling you things that were wrong. All the false prophets had been getting away with it during the days of Manasseh and Ammon, and right when Josiah starts. This is a huge problem for Jeremiah. The false prophets caused all kinds of trouble for him. You're going to see them popping up in the prophecies of Jeremiah all the time. So this was tough because, Hezekiah had got rid of the idols. Manasseh pulls him back out again. And if you had been alive back then, you would have found it difficult to figure out who's telling the truth. It was a tough time. And so Josiah's trying to change the nation. Jeremiah comes in prophesying. He begins to prophesy in the 13th year of Josiah. And in the 18th year of Josiah, that's when he repairs the temple. He finds the book of the law, probably Deuteronomy at least. They renew the covenant at that time. Remember how Josiah actually says about him that when he went through his reformation, he learned a huge lesson from Manasseh. He didn't just take the idols and tear them down and throw them into Gehenna. He took their idols and he ground them to powder. He burned the Asherah poles that they had. He tried to make sure they couldn't just pull them back out again when he was gone. Josiah was an unbelievably committed person looking out over the horizon, trying to prepare for the future. And this is what he's doing. And Jeremiah comes along at this point, right at this key period when Josiah is making great strides, you think, and you find out, what does he do? He repairs the temple, they find the book of the law, and he made the people stand and take a covenant. You ever catch that in Chronicles? He made them do it. They didn't really want to do it. He made them do it. And so they did. They went along with what the king wanted. But in the book of Jeremiah, as you're going through Jeremiah, what you're going to see is Jeremiah tells us what was really happening in the nation. You read Chronicles and Kings, and it sounds like, wow, everybody went to Bible class. They all came to Sunday meeting. They stayed for Sunday school. They even went to Bible school during the summer. They were part of Josiah's reformation. Then you read Jeremiah, as we read today in chapter 10. All about the idols that they had. He couldn't get rid of the idols. You go to Ezekiel and you find out God finally says, look, this is ridiculous. You can get rid of the idols all you want. They're in their hearts. I can't get them out, God says. The only way to do this is to take them up to Babylon and regrow the good figs. That was God's only choice. And as you're going to see, Jeremiah didn't agree. He doesn't agree with that. He thinks God is wrong. Just like other prophets have thought God was wrong. And God patiently, slowly helps Jeremiah realize, yeah, God's right, Jeremiah. This is the way it's going to have to be. So things were looking great until you read Jeremiah. You remember in the readings just a week ago in Jeremiah 3? Remember? And yet he's talking about, you know, how God had extended mercy to the people, how God had like taken the northern kingdom and sent them up and carried them away captive. And he talks about Israel, the two sisters, Israel and Judah. And you know, he says in verse 10, and yet for all of this, for all the things that Judah had witnessed about what God had done with the northern kingdom, he'd left on record for them in their lifetime, things they could actually look at and watch. He says, for all this, her treacherous sister Judah has not turned to me with her whole heart, but in pretense, says the Lord. And the Lord said to me, backsliding Israel has shown herself more righteous than treacherous Judah. And by the way, all the quotations I have up there, they're all from the American version, which we call the New King James. If you're here for the first class, you'll notice I can't read the English version, so I stick to the American versions because there's too many of those words in the English version I don't understand. And yes, I do agree that English and American are two totally different languages. If you don't believe that, just take a section of the King James Bible sometime, copy it into Microsoft Word, and look at all the grammatical errors and all the spelling mistakes there are. And I used to wonder as a child why I had trouble spelling things in school. So there were certain words I just couldn't get right until I did that one day and realized that's why I couldn't get it. I was taught between a King James Bible and looking at how they spelled them in England and how we spelled them here in America. And they marked them all wrong on my paper. So anyways, I went with the American version. That's why I'm using a New King James Bible for most of these today, and if not, I'll probably mention it up there. So the problem that Jeremiah is going to be dealing with, brothers and sisters, is it's very easy to have a formal, look-good religious system. You go to all the meetings. You show up to all the things. You know, it looks, on the surface, it looks great. But you get below the surface and you find out, well, what's really going on at home? How do mom and dad really treat each other at home? How do you treat the kids? Where do you really rank the Bible readings at home? When it gets time to the home studies, then you start finding out what people were really doing. And when they went home, they wanted to have fun. They liked their idols. They liked the way of life of the Canaanites. And so they turned to that, even though they were showing up to the meetings in Josiah's day. And you find this in Jeremiah. Jeremiah 4, for thus says the Lord in verse 3 to the men of Judah and Jerusalem, break up your fallow ground and do not sow among thorns. Circumcise yourselves to the Lord and take away the foreskins of your hearts, lest my wrath come forth like fire. Here comes that fire, and it's going to burn, and nobody is going to quench it. It's not going to stop this time. This time, it's going to burn until the nation is gone. And that was the warning that he had. Now, you can see, circumcise yourselves. He's trying to get them to get beyond the formal, beyond the stuff that looks good, the circumcision, the outward show. The same kind of problem the Apostle Paul has when he's writing his letters. This isn't about how we dress. It's not about, you know, what kind of car we drive. It's not going to be about like what meetings we attended. God is interested in seeing his character in us. He wants to know, have we learned to show mercy like he does? And he's giving us all these opportunities to practice it in our families and our ecclesias. And he's trying to figure out if we've learned how to reflect his character. That's what he cares about. The other stuff doesn't matter to him. It never did matter, but they thought it did. And what happens to most religions over time, as a religion gets longer and longer in years and it grows, it's got more and more history, the formal type of religion is elevated as being the important thing, and really the character of God thing is sort of like a sideline that, you know, maybe eventually you get there someday. And it isn't just Christadelphians. You look across, all the religions of the world do it. You know, I've seen it when I've been in Dubai with the Muslim community. They do the same thing. All of the emphasis on formalism. The Catholics have done it here in the U.S. The Christian churches have done it. And if we're not careful, Christadelphians can do it too. We emphasize the outward stuff, the formal religion. You know, did you take the bread and the wine? Like, you know, does that matter? Well, yes, it matters if it's making an impact like God had hoped. If you really have learned to show forth the death of Christ to sin by the way you live, it's not about bread and wine. It's about learning to live like Jesus Christ, to have the faith of Jesus Christ. That's what it's all about. And all of the formal stuff was designed by God to try to help us get to the next level. but don't ever be satisfied with the formal. And this was the problem that they ran into. And so he says in Ezekiel's time, Ezekiel 14, this would be about the sixth year of Zedekiah. He says, look, through Ezekiel, look at the problem that I really have here. We've gotten rid of the idols. I've taken you up to Babylon. You don't even have the idols with you anymore. But look at the problem is in the land that people have the idols in their hearts. And we've got to bust them of this. We've got to break them. And so God came up with a plan. You know, maybe the angels got together and they discussed it. And here was the plan. Take them out of the land. Regrow the good figs in Babylon and bring them back later. Maybe that will do it. Now, did it work? You ever thought about that? Did it work? When they came back from Babylon in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, did you hear anything about idolatry? Scan your Bibles in your heads for a minute. Do you remember anything about idolatry? Nope. It worked. It actually was successful. It was a good designed plan to knock the idols out of their hearts. Instead, what they did is they developed formalistic religions where they emphasized the law and they got into the Pharisee kind of things. So different problems developed, but it did work. And this is what Jeremiah's message is going to be about. He's got to tell the nations that God needs to do this. He doesn't really have another plan. So when you go back and look at what happened with the Jews in the readings that we've already done so far, remember back in chapter 3 where he predicted that they would come when you won't anymore say the Ark of the Covenant. We have the Ark. Like, we are the special people, right? Because we've got the Ark. You're not even going to think about the Ark. It won't even come to mind anymore because that was not important. Is what it stood for, the Lord Jesus Christ, the mercy seat that was there, the ability of a high priest to take you into the most holy place if you change your ways. That's what it was all about. It wasn't about the Ark and who has the Ark. God said in chapter 6 about their offerings, you know, what's the point of bringing frankincense from Sheba? You really think I care about frankincense? Do you think I care about all these offerings you're doing? No, I didn't care about those things. He didn't want them because they weren't sincere. Or when you get to chapter 7, we were just there earlier this week. Did you catch that? How God says, I didn't ask for sacrifices. You go back and look, Israel. When I brought you out of Egypt and took you through the wilderness and took you over to Mount Sinai and you were there in the mountain when it was on fire and everything, did I say, bring a sacrifice? No. He said, obey the Lord. Obey his voice. And Jeremiah keeps coming back to that. The whole sacrificial system and all this law and everything that they got, the law of Moses, that was supposed to help them step up to obey his voice. And they missed it. They went back to their formal legalistic religion, which had no power to change their lives. He talks about in chapter 4 about circumcising the foreskin of their hearts that we looked at. He says in chapter 6, verse 10, their ears are uncircumcised. They can't hear the word of God. Uncircumcised ears. And finally, in chapter 9, they were uncircumcised in their hearts. And so he says, look, I'm going to have to. In Jeremiah 8, in just the readings 2 days ago, I'm going to give their wives to others and their fields to those who will inherit them. Because from the least even to the greatest, everyone is given to covetousness. They're all looking around like, "What? I want what the other guy has." Right? The marketing strategy of today. You got to have this. You got to have it. You need to have this, right? You got to have. And so this is what happened to this time period. This is what we're living in today. Got to have all these things, these toys, all the latest and greatest. They were all given to covetousness. From the prophet even to the priest, everyone deals falsely or in pretense is what that was really all about. Now, when you go back and look at Jeremiah himself, he was probably born about the same time as Josiah, when you go back and figure out time-wise, because most of the priests began their ministry somewhere around 20 or 25 years old. So he's probably about the same time. He would have been excited at Josiah's reforms. He would have thought, this is great. Josiah's going to change the nation. Now, Jeremiah trained to be a priest. He was of the priests of Anathoth. You find out in Jeremiah 1 at verse 1, it says his dad was Hilkiah and that he was of the priests of Anathoth. I think that Hilkiah is probably the Hilkiah who's the high priest. And so, you know, you look back at what he went through. He started out at that point and now God wants him to be a prophet. A prophet. Think about prophets in your background. You want to be a prophet. If God offered you that today, what would you do? What if God said to you, I want you to be a prophet? And you think back through like prophets, you mean like Elijah and Obadiah hiding in the caves? You know, you think about the life of a prophet. You want to be a prophet instead of a priest? Priest, man, people come to us, right? They bring us food. They take care of us. You want me to be a prophet? prophets had a terrible life in Israel. And yet, that's what God did. He called them to be a prophet. You're going to change your job. He prophesied for at least 40 years, and you know, he continued till he's at least 65 years old. You can actually figure this out. So when you see him down in the mire, when we get to Zedekiah in the last class, you got to remember in that period there, he's about a 65, 70-year-old man, dropped down into the cistern, and you know, finally Ebed-Melech pulls him up with the ropes and the rags. He's a 65, 70-year-old man. But what a great example to us, brethren and sisters, of faithful ecclesial service to a family and an ecclesia that hated him. They hated him. You're going to find that out this week, and if you haven't caught that in the readings, they hated Jeremiah. They despised him. They couldn't stand a word that he had to say. They didn't want to listen to him. His own family hated him. And that's what he did. He continued faithful right to the end, even went down to Egypt with them, trying to save who he could and to work with them. What a great example of just doing what you can. If you've never done this before and you go through and look at the years, you can see how Jeremiah's prophecy was at least 40 years. He prophesied a long time. And during that time period, God's winning him over. Finally, by the end of chapter 20, you'll find out in chapter 20, if you ever wonder like why that depressed chapter is there, where Jeremiah finally spills the beans and says, oh, I cursed the day on which I was born. I wish I'd been a stillborn child. You know, and he goes through all these things that, God, you fooled me. I didn't realize what I was getting into. But he then tells the people, I'm going to do it. And you never hear anything after chapter 20 about any challenge anymore to God. God has won him over by that point. As you're going through the readings over the next week, you'll see that when you get to chapter 20. So the life of the priest was a lot better than being a prophet. He is called from birth. You'll see in chapter 1, if you look at verse 5, it says that God knew him before he was ever born. So you pick that up. And before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were even born, I sanctified you, and I ordained you a prophet to who? Did you notice that in chapter 1, verse 5? They used to really bother me. You ever read that? I used to underline that in my old Bible. I was like, someday I'm going to figure that out. A prophet to the nations. It wasn't just to Judah. He's a prophet to the nations. And then you start to figure out, well, what's God doing through Jeremiah? And finally, that starts to come out as you go through the book. He was a prophet to the nations. That's what God was trying to do with him. Whoops. Go back there. So what God did is Jeremiah himself, though, you'll find out, he didn't really want to be a prophet. You can see it's a discouraging job. It really wasn't something he wanted. You'll see in chapter 1 as you're going through there that he really didn't want to do it. But God is going to promise to protect him. As we're going through chapter 1, look in verses 18 and 19, you're going to see that that's what Jeremiah did. He listened to what God said. God said, look, I made you bronze walls, iron pillars. You're going to stand strong and you're going to take care of it and they won't prevail against you. And at that point, if I had heard that, there's no way I would have been thinking about being thrown in the mire. I wouldn't be thinking about being put in the stocks and all twisted up at the gate of Benjamin that Pasher does to him in chapter 20, and he's just like left there for everybody to laugh at him while they're walking into the temple. That was not what Jeremiah had expected, and he does feel deceived. He feels like he got fooled by God because he didn't realize what he was getting into, and that's why in chapter 19 he gets so discouraged he wishes he wasn't even born. But Jeremiah works through this, and the amazing thing is God lets him work through it. I mean, that's to me one of the most impressive things when you watch how God deals with the prophets. We aren't that patient, brethren and sisters, with each other. We go to ecclesial business meetings, or we have young people's meetings at our CYC, and you find out somebody's off on a topic. We just want to like fix it right now and get out our Bibles and get all the verses. It's like, did you get it? You got it? You've got to say yes to that now, or you might be on a disfellowship list. And I mean, that is our natural bend. But you watch how God just patiently works with prophets. And prophets like Habakkuk, prophets like Elijah for all of his problems, prophets like Jeremiah, God doesn't write them off. He doesn't mandate right now. He warns them and he works with them, but he gives them time to work through it. And that's really the way we should be with our kids and with other people's kids and with all the folks in our ecclesia. Now, this handout that you've got right here, this one I actually picked up out of Brother Harry Whitaker's book for the most part. Most of that came from him. At least he got me started. I talked to Ron Colley one time when he was in Detroit, and I said, what do you think about Chapin's family over here? Because Brother Harry doesn't include Chapin's family in the chart. And Ron thought the same thing I did. We got the feeling he's actually part of the family as well, because we know that one of the brothers up in here was Azaliah, and Chapin is the son of Azaliah. So I've thrown Chapin's family in over here as well. And you're going to see down here, I differed a little bit with Ezra. Ezra, he's got Ezra as being further down, Harry Whitaker does, because if you ever study the chronology of the Ezra and Nehemiah period, a lot of people think that the Ezra period is pushed much further into the King Artaxerxes. I don't buy into that myself. I think it's actually quite a bit sooner. And so I put Ezra up here as being the son of Sariah, because that's what he is called every time in the Bible. Ezra, the son of Sariah the priest. So Ezra is probably in Jeremiah's family line as well. So there's Jeremiah's family, and when you look through that, nearly all of his contemporaries across the line right there, nearly all of them rejected him except Shaphan. You got one good family line over there out of the whole thing. So Hilkiah the high priest was probably his dad. When you go through and look at, you know, what was going on, you know, you find out he's of the priests in Anathoth. They're right up there by Jerusalem. You look at things that Jeremiah was given, the privileges that he was given to do. You know that he must have had some kind of status for what he was allowed to do, sort of like Isaiah and some of the things that Isaiah was allowed to do. So you find out that he was probably raised in Anathoth to be one of the priests up there. Abiathar's descendants were also up in there, so there's always this great debate about which line you're going to go through, you know, the line of Abiathar or the line of the other priests. And Jeremiah, we know, had easy access to the king in chapter 22, 34. He was given special treatment by the rulers. You know, all of the rulers seemed to like treat him differently than they treated other people. When you go back and look at what happened, Jehoiakim, he put Urijah to death for what he had to say. But when Jeremiah goes out there and the people charge him with treason because he says that, you know, God's going to make Shiloh, like Jerusalem, like Shiloh, then Jeremiah is not put to death. They actually, one of the sons of Shaphan actually helped him survive that. And we'll look at later on this week. So Zedekiah allows Ebed-Melech to get him out of the pit, we find out later on. The princes and the priests in chapter 36 allowed a scroll to be read in the priest's chamber before the king that had come from Jeremiah. And Nebuchadnezzar in the end tells Nebuzaradan to look after Jeremiah. So God was looking out for him. This could have been, it's possible this could be the result of Daniel working with Nebuchadnezzar. It wouldn't surprise me at all that, as far as how Nebuchadnezzar treated Jeremiah so differently. But when you look at his own family didn't support him. You know, Azariah, the high priest, and his, probably his brother at that point, and Gemariah, his other brother, they dealt treacherously with him, we'll see in chapter 12. Zedekiah, his cousin, this is not King Zedekiah, a different one, prophesied lies against him. Azariah, you know, his cousin, claimed that he lied when he said later on that God said, don't go down to Egypt. So his own family members at this point, even that late into it, didn't support him. And Sariah and Zephaniah and probably many other family members, they were taken away when Nebuchadnezzar killed them at Riblah, and Nebuzaradan slew them at that point. So Jeremiah didn't have much impact on his family. If you're ever wondering, you know, you're one of those people that's, you know, discouraged that you're not able to have a huge impact on your family, take heart. Jeremiah didn't either, but he kept trying, because there were other people he was able to influence. And Shaphan's family is going to be one of those, you'll see. And all the good figs that went up to Daniel, Daniel in Babylon, there were people up there Jeremiah was having an influence on, and they were going to be the basis of the future ecclesia when they came back from Babylon. But when you look at his own family members right there, that whole line there in green, they all rejected Jeremiah. They did not support him. Shaphan's the one case that we have that actually it's very clear that he did support him. And that's the way it worked. Jeremiah's family were not very supportive. You'll also find not only Shaphan's family over here, all of these guys, his sons and his grandsons, Jaazaniah there, he's a different case. He's one of the radical black sheep in the family. Jaazaniah, he's the guy who was like going into the, when God showed Ezekiel, look at these fellows, they're going through into the temple, they've got these pictures of lizards on the wall, and they're bowing down to the lizards. Jaazaniah is one of those guys who did that. Whereas Barak, on the other hand, coming up through this same family right there, Barak was certainly connected with Jeremiah and very supportive. Barak was the fellow who wrote down many of Jeremiah's prophecies. So there were some people who helped him, a lot of people, though, who didn't. You look at how discouraging Jeremiah's life would be. I remember reading through these things one time when, you know, things had gone wrong in our life a bit. And then you look at what God asked Jeremiah to do. You know, imagine God coming to you or a prophet coming to you today and saying, look, you get to chapter 16 in the readings this week. You watch what he's asked to do. Chapter 16, this would be during like probably the time period of Jehoiakim, that nasty, terrible king. All right, verse 2, don't take a wife, don't have any kids. It's not worth having a family right now down in the land. Because don't even bother thinking about having kids because things are going to get so bad. You read in Lamentations, they got bad. Moms were eating their children. God said, look, this is not a time to have a wife and kids. That's how bad it's going to be. It's like when Jesus said, pray, you know, later on that your flight not be on the Sabbath. You know, woe to the ones that are pregnant in those days. He saw what was coming to Jerusalem. No grieving at the funerals. Verse 5, when somebody dies, even one of your family members, you can't go to a funeral and grieve with them. Don't be sad. You have to show the people that when the community dies, God's not going to be grieving. He gave you all these opportunities. And no, God's not going to be grieving. He's starting over. He's got a different group up in Babylon he's going to be working with. No parties, right? You think back in even under the law, three times a year, the males were supposed to show up to Jerusalem and they were supposed to have a happy time. It was supposed to be a joyful time. God wanted them to rejoice. You know, no parties for Jeremiah. Don't go to the birthday parties. Don't go to any of these parties because this is not going to be a time to party. You got to get serious. Terrible things are coming on the community. And you look at what Jeremiah goes through in his life, brothers and sisters, if you ever think you've got it bad, really read the book of Jeremiah. Find out what he went through, what God put him through in order to help change other people. It really wasn't so much for Jeremiah. It was so that he could help others, and he did. He had a huge impact on some of the people of his generation. So when you look at Jeremiah's message, his message to the Jews was, an army's coming out of the north. Did you notice that in chapter 1? In chapter 1, it's hard to pick that up if you're reading the English version. But if you look down in chapter 1 about the boiling pot in verse 13, that boiling pot is actually facing away from the north, not toward the north. Because what he saw was a boiling pot, like a pot that's boiling away, and it's up in the north, and it gets tipped over, and it just flows down to the south. And God says, that's what it's going to be like when I bring the army from the north. You may have noticed in the readings this past week about all the references to the northern army coming down. So Jeremiah had to tell the people, you've got to change before this army from the north comes down and invades, and it's too late at that time. And that was his message. And so once the Babylonians arrived in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, you know, you'd think, well, you know, if you had been Jeremiah, imagine how exciting it would have been in a sense. Jehoiakim's there, the fourth year, which is why a lot of those prophecies are around the fourth year of Jehoiakim in your chart. So the army comes down, Nebuchadnezzar's there, surrounds the city, and Jeremiah is thinking, yes, they're going to believe me now. They're going to finally believe. The army from the north has come down. Yes, they're going to finally understand. Daniel going away captive. They're going to realize I'm right. And then God says, okay, Jeremiah, it's time for phase two. Phase two is, what's his new message? He's not going to say the army from the north is coming down anymore. What has he got to tell them? What are you supposed to do? What are you supposed to do? The Jews never wanted to do. Surrender. And walk out of Jerusalem. And they charge him with traitor. He's a traitor. And that's what happened to the poor man. At the very time when you think like things are finally being fulfilled and things are going to get better for him personally, the message changes. Now you got to tell him to surrender. Then they charge him with treason. You know, that's what happens. He finally gets put in the stocks and he gets thrown into prison all because of that message. But the message is still there, brothers and sisters, to change before the end begins. So the prophets of the nations, all right, that's his message. In chapter 1, God says, you're going to be a prophet to the nations. And I really think that what God said was essential at this point. If you look at this from God's perspective, remember when he came out of Egypt, when he brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, he wanted to make sure that not just the people got out of Egypt, but that Yahweh had triumphed over all the gods of Egypt. That was a big issue to the God of Israel. He didn't want any of the other nations misunderstanding. It was that he had beat every Egyptian god. And now when he goes to take his people out of the land up to Babylon, what's his problem? What's God's problem? He doesn't want anybody thinking that Bel and Nebo beat him. Has he ever looked at it from his perspective? He wants to make that really clear to the world. Everybody needs to understand when the people of the Jews are removed out of the land, you can't go thinking that Yahweh lost. Oh no, he's not the loser here. And so he sends Jeremiah and Daniel and Ezekiel to educate the world on why God is removing his people. And that's part of what Jeremiah is doing. So he has to say, look, Yahweh's the one responsible, not the idols of the nations. Oh, and you find out what will happen is that he says finally later on that once this happens, in turn, God's going to destroy all of these nations. Chapter 25 is all about that, how once it's done, he's going to destroy these nations because they went way beyond what he had intended, and they really didn't give Yahweh any credit for it, even though he tried. So what you've got is down in Jerusalem right now is Jeremiah is telling the people to surrender to Babylon, and he's telling the other nations that come down there that Yahweh is responsible for removing his people. You've got Daniel up in Babylon working with Nebuchadnezzar, trying to educate him that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomsoever he wills. And you've got Ezekiel in Babylon and up there in by the river Kibar working with the captives that were taken up there, trying to encourage them to settle down, have a life. It's going to be a while, 70 years, because God, your God, is responsible for this. This was a big issue to our God. He didn't want anybody thinking he had lost the war. And so that's what he does. And so what you'll find as you go through this last part of the chapter of Jeremiah chapter 1, maybe we'll pick up some of that tomorrow, but that's what he does with Jeremiah is he tries to get him on board and educate him that this is what we're going to need to do. Now, some of the lessons for today, because we're out of time, lessons, all right? Look, there may be times in our lives, brothers and sisters, where we need to redirect our lives to God. You may not be interested in being involved in CYC, but you might need somebody in your ecclesia to take up the CYC and really run with it. That's an important thing to our God. Or in prophecy, in seminars, I mean, if there's nobody doing it, we may have to change our job, change what we're interested in. It may be that you have to change your actual job, that you're not going to be able to work where you work because you need to get a little closer to an ecclesia for your family, for your kids, for you. But there are going to be times like that where we may have to redirect our lives for God, just like Jeremiah did, and we can't walk away from that. Don't ever be satisfied with a formal religion. When you go to meeting on Sunday, when you go to Bible class, don't ever think in your mind you're checking it off. All right, when you do the readings at home, you may cross them out on your Bible companion thing or something, but this isn't about formal religion. God doesn't care about that at all. That is a basis to get to the next levels of developing his character. And if what we're doing right now in our lives isn't developing the character of God, if it isn't teaching us to be kind and patient and merciful and loving and forgiving, we're missing the boat. We're going through the motions like these people did, and we're missing the boat. Something's got to change. And while we're at Bible school this week, this is the time to think about the changes. This is where you make commitments to God, to your spouse, to your kids. When we go home, we're going to try something different. We're going to try something different because what we're doing isn't working. This is where it happens. And look at, for the older ones that are here, there is no retirement. It's not like you get up to 65 and you're done. Jeremiah at 65 was down in the mire. He comes out of there and goes to Egypt with the people, committed to the end. That's what God is looking for. And don't wait, brothers and sisters, thinking that when Christ returns, we're going to change. It's going to be too late. Too late. It's got to happen now. So hopefully tomorrow what we'll do is look at the failure of the people, and we'll get a chance to move on there. Thanks very much.